You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, July 21st, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayen. Reporting on this year's Netroots Nation, and in particular, his thoughts on the Black Lives Matters protest during the presidential forum at Netroots Nation. Also on the program today, UN votes to lift sanctions on Iran. Meanwhile, AIPAC going to town. Well, they're already in town. They're already in Washington, D.C. Going all in on spending to fight this deal. Meanwhile, the NYPD, responsible for hundreds of thousands of dollars of payouts to Occupy Wall Street protesters, and millions to the family of Eric Garner. And a devastating warning on climate change from James Hansen, one of the premier climate scientists in the country. A new report out, which is rather disturbing, suggesting that in 50 years, when little Ezra Binder is cutting YouTubes for Mila and bossing and Saul, we won't be just steps away from the Gowanus Canal, but the Gowanus Canal, we may actually be broadcasting from inside it. Funny to joke about, horrible to imagine. And lastly, it turns out Breitbart.com's Ben Shapiro is an obnoxious, hateful, whiny-ass titty baby. Is that what it, what is it? I can't even remember. It's been a long time since I've heard or used that expression. Whiny-ass titty baby? Whiny? TD whiny baby? I can't remember. I can't remember what it is. I think, I know we had one on our promos on the old Majority Report. Folks, we're going to get to David Dayen in a moment. Just a couple of house cleaning notes. One, Michael's not here today, which he didn't tell me that he wasn't coming in till late. But let's not hold that against Michael or you. Just remember that it is your membership that makes this show possible and will allow me to keep Michael in enrolled in his yoga class and his healing class and his...
Subsidizing his rough night at the wine bar.
Yeah, exactly. Give him bonuses with crystals and gift certificates for Chablis or whatever it is he's drinking over there. You can become a member at majority.fm. We go through periods where we have people a certain amount of cancellations and in part because people can't afford to maintain membership. If you can afford to do it, please become a member today to support both the free show and as a bonus, we give you anywhere from 40, 50, sometimes an hour extra of content, sometimes an hour and a half of extra content on a daily basis. And again, if you're one of those folks who can't afford to become a member but want access to that bonus material, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will set you up. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. It's great coffee, and the shipping is free. You can also get the Majority Report blend. Give that as a gift to your friends. Justcoffee.coop. And lastly, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayan. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. Someone who I have always made sure to interview. I don't know if it was. This was the first Netroots Nation, formerly Yearly Co's, that I have not attended. 9 out of 10, I think I went to. And I think out of maybe 9 of those, I think I interviewed this person while we were there to get a sense of what was happening at the conference, what was different. I'm sort of attempting to do the same without having been there this year. David Dayan, a writer for Salon.com and for The New Republic and for The Pacific Standard and for Naked Capitalism. Am I leaving anybody out there, David?
You're probably leaving everybody out, but let's just move on.
Okay. And of course, you can always go to his Tumblr page to find out what he's written most recently. So David, this year in Phoenix, and we should go back to last year in Detroit, there was some controversy at the time about the choice of Phoenix. Because I think there was some sense, well, aside from it being 107 degrees in Phoenix in the middle of the summer, there was also some question as to whether or not this is the type of place you want to go to based upon this state's record of immigration policies. And I have to say that based upon what was being discussed in national media during Netroots, it seemed to make some sense for me. And maybe that was just a coincidence, but I want to get your sense as having been there.
Well, I think that was actually kind of overblown. And, you know, actually what I think is that Netroots going to Phoenix was incredibly useful. And if it wasn't for this Saturday event that kind of overtook everything that happened, I would say that, that the theme of Netroots was to show largely white liberal progressives what brown people go through in this country every day. There were a number of very unique panels and discussions and keynotes on the local plight of undocumented immigrants. On Friday, there was a very large protest at Joe Arpaio, the Maricopa County Sheriff's his Fourth Avenue jail and also his headquarters, with hundreds of people who were at the event. This is an echo of in Detroit. As you remember, there was a big protest over the water rationing and the shutoff of the water of poor people. This is what Netroots has become. I mean, we've talked about sort of these evolutions of that event, going from these people with very, you know, bloggers with very precise information about congressional races, and then it became kind of a trade show for the professional left. And really what it's moved into, I feel, is a movement-based organizing space, particularly local organizing. And I think that, that there was such a presence of local organizers there that I think that the this idea that, that Phoenix was out of bounds or not a place to go was turned out to be, you know, not very relevant.
Was there much? I mean, I hadn't heard much of that discussion leading up to Netroots, and I should say that, you know, this year I just happened, it was the only time I could go and visit my sister overseas, and so it was
whatever,
more of,
Sam. Right. You know, just whatever, right? I mean, I got my 10 for 10 badge here with they actually gave out a button for 10 timers, and you know.
Well, that's. Let me ask you this. Were there many 10-timers? I mean, because one statistic I saw was that 40% of the attendees, and I don't have a sense of how many people were there, but I do get the sense that each year it seems to be more and more people there. But 40% of the attendees had never been to one previously. And I'm.
Yeah, there were a lot of newbies, and 3,000 people, I think, was the final attendance number. And a lot of new people, and it definitely felt that way. And the old timers like me are fewer and fewer, as we go along. So that's definitely true. And that's why I say it's just sort of an evolving, group, of people and an evolving focus, on organizing and sort of movement-based politics. And in some ways, I guess the term identity-based politics is kind of off-limits maybe, but that's what it's moving towards as well, and I think that's what, you know, we certainly saw on Saturday.
Yeah, and I want to get to that in a moment, and just even that conversation about this notion of identity politics, because I wonder if that is a fair assessment of what we saw. But before we get there, I want to get a little more broader sense of what's going on there, because you know, I do recall in the middle ages of Netroots Nation that idea of it being a trade show of some sorts, and that there was a lot of, you know, maybe more union presence, maybe more, I guess, older or established organizational presence. And what I'm hearing from you, and I think it's reflected in the decision to go to Detroit in retrospect more, the decision to go to Phoenix, and the decision to go to St. Louis next year.
Yeah, next year.
That it's becoming more about, in some ways, I mean, is grassroots accurate to talk about grassroots organization?
Local organizing, bringing their perspective to national progressives of what is happening on the ground in certain areas that are in crisis. And I think that's the only way you can describe what is happening in a place like Arizona, along the border, where, you know, there are people that go out and hang up jugs of water for people who are making the struggle to walk across the desert to bring a better life for their families, and who are, you know, subject to other groups that cut down the jugs of water, for example. You know, I mean, there were a lot of, I think, eye-opening moments for people who aren't exposed to this kind of issue very often. And I think it made, you know, some kind of impact. And it's very interesting that until Saturday morning, I think there was this real show of unity, cross-cultural, cross-identity, if you want to call it that, across the progressive movement. There really was a decent amount of solidarity around these ideas. And then we had what transpired on Saturday, which I think at some small level may have exacerbated a problem of that we see in the Republican Party as well, where you have these disparate first of all, with respect to the Democrats, it's sort of the racial and economic justice wings and points of emphasis within the party. I mean, in the Republican Party, maybe you're talking about social conservatives and defense conservatives and economic conservatives. And I think you have that to a different degree. Obviously, the issues aren't the same on the Democratic side, on the progressive side. And that was in full display on Saturday.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about that. Set the scene for us. I was 2007, I guess. There was a similar presidential forum at that time. The race was a little bit tighter, and so
yeah.
You had Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, and.
Yeah, that guy.
And exactly. And I can't remember if there was anybody else there, but certainly those three were there. I feel like there was one.
Everybody. It was actually everyone who was in the race, with the exception of Biden, was at the 2007 Networks Nation. This year, you only had two of what I guess are five nominees, and you didn't have the front runner.
Right.
And that does kind of tell you something about where Networks is at, actually.
But does it?
Whereas,
I mean, does it?
I
mean,
it
because
does. I think in 2007 it was seen as a constituency to be managed, and now it's something a little different.
Well, what is that difference? Is it now that, I mean, because I attribute it from afar to the fact that the front runner's up 40 points, and so why risk it?
Race, yeah.
I mean, honestly,
well,
like, you know, because
race,
I remember.
Risk it? I can tell you that there were discussions to have her there. If she was going to attend, it was going to be a much bigger thing, probably with a media partner. And this is about all I can say about this. There would have been a much bigger presence, and it would have kind of been like another debate. And basically, the Clinton camp has agreed to a very set amount of debates, and so why add another one?
Right,
so I think,
and
that's true. The other point is that the day before, there was a forum with all five candidates in Iowa, And so O'Malley and Sanders flew across the country to get to this the next day. And I can see the reason why you wouldn't want to do that if you were Hillary Clinton.
And, you know, look, I recall in 2007, I remember specifically one of the biggest things coming out of that exchange was Hillary Clinton saying, you know, you shouldn't get on corporate lobbyists so much.
Yeah, that lobbyists aren't all that bad.
Yeah, yeah, and mm-hmm. that really stuck with her. I mean, it's hard to know what the implications of something like that are. Obviously, you know, I think it's easy to overestimate the power that you know, those people attending Netroots Nation had at that time, but that got out into the mainstream media, and that became a you know, one sort of, I guess, issue point going forward. And so I attributed it to you know, you're way up in the polls. Why engage in something that could only probably hurt you?
Right. I mean, there are different factors in every presidential campaign that, you know, play into that. I mean, next you're going to hear as an aftermath of what happened that next year, no presidential candidate will ever come to Netroots Nation again. Of course, next year's Netroots Nation is a week before the DNC.
Right.
So I would doubt that any presidential candidate would come.
No.
So it's just it depends on the factors. If there was a very competitive race going on right now, and people had to scrape and claw to get whatever support they could get, sure, they'd be there.
And that was where I was going with that. I mean, we sort of put the cart before the horse.
I do agree with that.
Yeah, let's put the horse back in front of the cart and talk about. You're at this forum. Martin O'Malley is out there. And so you interviewed two of the organizers, or at the very least, two of the people who got up on stage, right? There was Ashley.
Well, one of them was on stage, Tia Osa, and then one of them who was doing a call and response from the floor.
And that's Ashley Yates, of Black
Ashley
Lives
Yates,
Matter.
Correct.
And Tia Osa is the Black Alliance for Just Immigration National Director, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, and she's from Arizona, and actually that was instrumental in putting together the Arpaio protest the day before. And right before that forum, I attended a panel with Patrice Cullors, who's a co-founder of Black Lives Matter, about police reform. There's kind of this inference by these activists that Netroots Nation wasn't allowing them to speak, and that's really not true. I mean, they were very active, and just as everyone else was. I mean, that kind of smacks me as, you know, the typical, well, where is the panel on my issue kind of thing. When you know, it's usually not the case. And so, you know, that is one area where I would say that they were, you know, not being terribly accurate about what was going on. Because when she got up, when dozens of them stormed toward the stage, and when they got up, one of the things they were really talking about was, you know, our voices have to be prominent, and we will not be silenced. Well, they weren't really silenced over the course of the weekend.
Now, was your sense that this was a protest about Netroots, or was it that...
At first, it was kind of. I mean, I do feel like that was part of it. If you listened to Tia Osa on stage and what she was actually talking about, obviously the second thing was they took the most high-profile part of this particular event and very deliberately tried to shut it down and to call attention and raise awareness to what they describe as a state of emergency in the Black community. which I think is completely justified. This was in the wake of Sandra Bland,
right?
The woman who was murdered in Texas.
And we should say that the DA just announced, I guess it was yesterday afternoon, that they are investigating this as a murder.
Good.
And
as they should be. So, if that happens while we're all there, and I think that was sort of the impetus for what they decided to do. And so they took the most high-profile piece that they could and used it to raise that awareness and also call out the presidential candidates for needing to have a serious criminal justice reform, anti-racism plank in their platform if they're going to be able to secure the votes of the black community. I think that was a large part of it.
And would you say, because, look, there is a structural problem here. There's obviously a structural problem in terms of racism and in terms of those specific issues. But from the standpoint of the presidential primary, there's a structural problem in that you have two of the whitest states in the country, if not the whitest, close to the white.
Two of the three.
In Iowa and New Hampshire, which, of course, is particularly in this race, crucial, right, for these guys. Because if they don't go anywhere in Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states, they're in big trouble in terms of,
yep,
of building some type of momentum. And when you're talking about states that are something like, I don't know, where the Democratic primary voters are something like 95, 97, 94% white, these guys, aside from any issues they may have or any reasons they may have from their current positions to not have an intimate understanding of these issues, okay, i.e., I'm the senator from Vermont, I say.
The other of the whitest states.
Aside from that, they're not speaking to these issues. And they may, and so on some level, if the protest was a function of Netroots, or at least partially a function of Netroots, at the very least, I think they exposed that the presidential candidates are a bit tone deaf. The Democratic presidential candidates, at least those two, are a bit tone deaf as to what's going on with this movement and what is driving it.
Yes. And, I go back and look at it through the frame of something that I know, which is stand-up comedy. That if you're in a room and someone is heckling you, you cannot continue with your set. Or if you're in a room and a glass falls in the back, you cannot not call attention at it. You have to be in the room and recognize what is going on in the room. And this is largely about Sanders because he was, this happened for 15, 20 minutes while he was sitting backstage. And he came on stage and he gave his stump speech. And they, that was not what the room wanted to hear at that moment.
Now, so wait a second. Give me a sense.
When you talk about tone deafness, that's tone deafness.
Were activists still on stage at that juncture?
No. So Tia,
walk us through.
There was only one activist who was ever on stage, and that's Tia.
Okay.
So she was brought up on stage. She was on there for about 10 minutes. There was a lot of chanting within the floor, on the floor, very close to the stage. But then Tia got off the stage and they, O'Malley was sort of given a chance to respond, but it was pretty brief. And finally they said, O'Malley's got to go. And there was nobody on stage at that point. But then Sanders comes on. And by the way, this crowd was incredibly pro-Sanders. He had a major presence at Netroots. By the way, Hillary had zero presence at Netroots. Zero. Like nothing. At all.
And it's funny because in Detroit, I remember there was a Ready for Hillary
party.
Right.
Huge party, but that was ready for Hillary. That was not the campaign. So, you know, a lot of pro-Sanders sentiment in the room. However, the most vocal part and the part of the room that was the obviously driving the conversation at that moment was looking for him to talk about this particular issue. And, you know, time and again, he would make the pivot back to an economic frame. And this is, you know, going to drive a lot of argument, I think, generally, where this idea of a divide between racial justice and economic justice. And is there a divide? And is it all about class and not race? And these kinds of questions. And ultimately, where I come down is you have to speak to both. I mean, you can go back and look at the fact that Sandra Bland was an educated woman who was going to Texas for a new job. She had a job, she had an education, right. And she was not immune to this police brutality that goes on in our communities. You can look at Nordic social democracies, which have high degrees of social spending, federal spending, and economic equality, and yet they have problems, particularly with their Muslim communities, but in general, problems with immigrant communities that flare up. So, you know, the question then becomes, does this lens, this economic lens, that if you make the possibilities more equal for all segments of society, that you fix the structural problems around racism that go on, that is, I think, the ultimate question that was brought up in this moment. And Sanders, you know, it was more, I mean, he obviously agrees on many of these points.
Right.
You know, this is a guy who was an organizer with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 60s, who did sit-ins for racial justice, who marched with Martin Luther King. But the people who I spoke with kind of said, well, that only goes so far. So talk to me about what you're going to do today. Don't tell me that you marched with my mom and dad. Tell me what you're going to do today for the state of emergency happening in these communities right now.
There's two things that I'm struck by. One is that I think that dynamic where you state what you've done 50 years ago now is also indicative. My sense is from talking to folks that there's a dynamic within that movement that is also that is similar in that respect. Like we're seeing the emergence of a new generation. That mm-hmm. generation is now old enough that there is some oxygen and some sunlight, I guess, for a new generation to sort of grow into a leadership position in a new civil rights movement. That's the first thing that occurs to me, and that Bernie Sanders was, and O'Malley to a certain extent, was just sort of caught in a I'm not clear on what's going on the ground anymore, because I'm too old, I'm older. And I don't know what the kids are up to these days. I mean, I think there's a little bit of that. I also think that there's a certain problem that the Black Lives Matter, that specific protest, is interpreted in some respects, I think, by white people. I don't know, maybe white people is too much of a generalization, but it's interpreted by some as being metaphorical, as opposed to specifically like, hey, we're literally statistically more apt to be killed. We are literally statistically more apt to be subject to sort of threats, and that there are specific and tangible steps that could be taken. Do you know what I mean?
Right, right. And O'Malley laid out a couple of those later. He then kind of undermined himself by repeating a phrase, Black Lives Matter, White Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, which the activists see as very dismissive. To his credit, O'Malley went back to the convention and on numerous occasions with numerous groups of people, including in public, apologized for that, explained what he was thinking, how he did not have the lexicon correct, and worked to win back the support. Now Sanders just took off. First of all, he left the forum early. He just walked out and then canceled all his events the rest of the day, including meetings with Black Lives Matter activists, including meetings with immigration rights activists. And then just, you know, sort of went in a room somewhere until his larger public event that evening before 11,000 people, where he gave a slightly more robust part of his speech to these issues. And then the following day in Dallas, did say the name Sandra Bland and talked about racism. And so there is a sense that he might have been learning a little bit, or at least, you know, tailored his remarks in a way that was more inclusive. But in that moment, he certainly didn't, and then he just sort of walked away. And so I think that engendered bad feelings as well, although, you know, maybe he started to clean that up.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost more disturbing in some ways and upsetting than his initial reaction. I mean, it's one thing to sort of get, you know, and it's hard to even make the argument that he got blindsided, right? I mean, he did have 15 minutes to sort of sit there and say, okay, this is what I'm walking into.
Right. And then he immediately starts into a clearly prepared remarks, you know, so it's a problem. And, you know, ultimately, what is the presidency about sometimes? It's about adapting to rapidly changing circumstances on the ground.
Right.
And being able to adapt to that and react to it, you know, that's part of the job.
Right.
So to the people who say that this isn't, you know, like, you know, having him pander to a protester or something is not the test of leadership. It actually kind of is in some ways, or at least knowing how to respond to that situation. It's part of what you have to do.
President. And we should say so, that it's not just a question of pandering to a specific audience. It's an assessment as to whether or not, you know, it's not like we have many opportunities like where we see Bernie Sanders in a position where he's got to think on his feet and adapt to changing circumstances, right? Like, we're not going to see him. Oh, he's on a gondola and the wire's broken. Let's see what he does. You know, it's not like we get this is about, you know, as tense as that we're going to have access to.
Right. They're limited experiences. Now, I will say that, you know, Hillary Clinton wasn't there. And the next day, after 2 days to think about it, she gave some remarks on a Facebook Q&A that were, you know, very much in line, I think, with what people might have wanted to hear. And the question is, will she be challenged on these issues in the same way? And what is, you know, what are the core things that Black Lives Matter really wants out of these candidates, and where is that movement going to go? There's actually a convention called the Movement for Black Lives this week.
Where is that taking place?
In Cleveland.
All right.
So I think it would be interesting to see what comes out of that in terms of a real agenda that's and, you know, I'm not sure this agenda is all applicable to national politics necessarily.
Right.
I think that a lot of it would be at the local level. But, It will be interesting to see. There is a critique here that
it's important. That, I think yes, and I think
that, yeah.
We're going to endeavor on this program. Maybe we'll try and track some folks down from that. If we don't end up being able to reach some of the, you know, either Tia or maybe Patrice Kohlers, mm-hmm. or Ashley Yates, but I'm not going to blame Michael for not being able to do that today. But all right, well, David,
well, maybe
Dan,
he just couldn't get a plane. Maybe he couldn't get a plane ticket to Phoenix.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, sometimes people just can't get to where they really should be.
David Dayan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
See you later.
All right, bye-bye. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to break format today. Give a call to Alon James White of TWIB, This Week in Blackness, who was also covering Netroots Nation at the time. Get a sense. I know he spoke to Martin O'Malley shortly after O'Malley walked off the stage. So we're going to break format, and we'll be right back in just a moment.
Driving all night, you could be a shadow beneath the streetlight behind my home. Driving on nine, I sure miss you. Past a motel, looking at the pines. Driving on nine, looking for 1:30. Maybe I passed it. Going.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the CEO of This Week in Blackness and the media director of Netroots Nation, Alon James White. Alon, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me, sir.
So, all right. So, Alon, you were obviously at Netroots. You were covering Netroots and also, I guess, functioning as the media director. And I know that you sat down with Martin O'Malley after he got off the stage. And I want to, you know, I want to, before we get to your reaction to what O'Malley had to do, I want to get your sense of Netroots from your perspective. I know that you've been there for at least the past several years. Obviously, you work for them, and with them. Give me your sense of how the conference is sort of evolving.
The overall Netroots Nation has it's the largest progressive conference in the country, and one of the issues that Netroots had, especially when I first started coming, like maybe 5-6 years ago, is that it was a very white space. It didn't actually represent the Democratic base as a whole, and over the years that has actually been changing. While it is nowhere near what it needs to be, it is still evolving in that way. And the power of Netroots is also being used in different ways, like the very fact that we were in Phoenix in the first place. I believe, like last year when we were in Detroit, a lot of attention was brought there about the water crisis, and it was great. And people came, and people were able to work with activists on the ground and support that space. And the same thing was basically the point of going to Phoenix, and now next year going to St. Louis. So it's become this space where actively going into in places in the country that are having problems and bringing the activism, bringing the attention to that space to hopefully support the people on the ground that need the help, as opposed to what happens a lot of times within the progressive space and the Democratic space, where you think someplace is a problem and you kind of just write it off and you're like, well, you shouldn't live there. Come to somewhere that's more liberal. Instead, just going to spaces and saying, no, we're going to have this conversation and hopefully help
make things better.
You know, it's interesting because I just interviewed David Dayan, who went to, you know, and this was the first Netroots that I wasn't able to attend. And he made the same point, that he feels that it's evolved into, you know, from that sort of a narrow or white sort of blogosphere world through almost a professional left into a more activist grassroots hub, if you will, and one that sort of that does go in to energize different local activists. And was it your sense that there was a strong contingency of local activists, you know, at the conference?
Absolutely. The Netroots actually did reach out to a lot of different places. We actually had went down to Arizona before the conference had happened, and we produced a series called the AZ Dispatch, where I went and I talked to various activists and spaces about what was happening, what issues were going on in Arizona as a whole and right by the border. And we talked about Operation Streamline. We went to the Colibri Center. We talked with No More Deaths and walked into the migrant trail just to like talk to them and find out what their work looked like, and then try to say, okay, great, we're going to highlight this. We're going to push this to the forefront over, so that people can have but see exactly what's happening, because a lot of people, even during the conference, had never heard of Operation Streamline. And it's like, that's the point, like getting these issues in front of people's eyes. And I think that's great. But there was some issues. Like, that's why the Black Lives Matter protests ended up happening, because they felt as if they weren't, in fact, included inside that space. So, I like I said, as much as there was work done to connect and be a part of the local community, there still has to be more involvement in bringing more people into the table when making these decisions.
Was it your sense, and obviously you can't speak for the protesters, but I'm curious as a participant and as somebody who is in the room, was it your sense that the protest was about the lack of inclusion or attention given the issues around Black Lives Matter at the conference, or one in which there is a sense that the those two candidates, anyways, they were the only ones there, were not as in touch with these issues as they should be?
In honesty, Tia Oso, who was actually on stage, said this numerous times, that they did not, in fact, go in there to protest O'Malley or Sanders directly, but this was a conversation about the inclusion of these issues of being part of the platform at Netroots Nation, coming into a space like Phoenix and not having folks in Phoenix like Tia Oso in that group being a part of the overall agenda. And the fact that, and basically a critique of the overall progressive space as a whole, which is in fact very, very white. And this has been a problem that's been going on for years. And it seems like progressives don't seem to understand, no matter how much like commentary around, like, hey, white progressive space is really problematic. Hey, you're not bringing very inclusion. Hey, you're constantly telling folks who are in marginalized spaces that their issue will come. But we have to work on these bigger things, because this affects everybody. And then if we fix this, then everybody will be better. It's like, but we are having certain issues that are directly affecting these communities, and you have to directly address them. Otherwise, they won't get fixed. And you know this, because it's been many, 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 many years, and these issues aren't even time to fix.
Right. And do you give me your sense? I mean, and obviously, I mean, you're media director of Netroots, and so, you know, we'll take that. But, I mean, give me your sense of, I mean, there's two critiques there. One is that Netroots in particular was not providing that kind of space to talk about those issues. And then there's the broader critique of the progressive movement in general is not doing it. Give me your sense about the critique about Netroots. I mean, was that do you think that was also a valid critique of that Netroots?
Yes, absolutely. The fact is, like, as much as the work is being done to broaden the overall campaign that Netroots brings and the coalition that comes with it, it still hasn't been fixed. I mean, there was a talk with us, some Native folks who felt like they were not, in fact, involved in Netroots, and they felt like they were being ornaments on the space, and they ended up immediately put together a panel to discuss that particular issue. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that the Netroots space wants to be as inclusive as possible. But the fact is, it's not always easy, especially when the space is created like it's created out of like this, the whole white progressive space. So there's a lot of fighting to fix just like the very nature of how everything works. And that was one of the reasons why I even joined the Netroots team, was to specifically make the space more diverse. That's why we broadcast there. We have the Twib media stage, and I highlight a lot of diverse voices, and we put people of color, we put marginalized folks, we put trans folks on the stage to let them have that space. But at the same time, that's my attempt to help do that, but there still is a lot more work to be done. And the thing is that everyone knows that. It's just about making sure it happens. And so when I see something like the BLM, the Black Lives Matter protests, I understand what happened. And I'm like, well, this is something that we need to look into. We have to continue absorbing this and not looking at it as some sort of attack on Netroots, because the fact is Netroots doesn't want to be what the white progressive space looks like. It's trying to be more inclusive. It's trying to be make sure that it looks like the Democratic base. So while it was definitely a critique on us, and I think that it needs to be, that we need to accept it, absorb it, and then fix it. But this, I really do look at this as a much bigger situation with the progressive space as a whole.
So, okay, and let's turn to the critique of the candidates, because, I mean, it was clear, and you spoke to O'Malley afterwards, but it was clear when he responded with "All Lives Matter" that he was basically saying, like, I'm not totally up on this, on what's going on here. But and I think, you know, my sense is that Bernie Sanders was in some respects even less willing to get off of his predetermined agenda, as it were. And I say this as a Bernie Sanders supporter.
Right.
But give me your sense. I mean, one thing that occurs to me, I mean, now, O'Malley may not have been able to understand, like, you know, saying all lives matter is, in addition to not getting what the sort of the rhetoric of the name Black Lives Matter, it was specifically something that people were using online to sort of quash that dissent. Aside from him not knowing that, and, you know, so he's not up on his you know, what's happening with on Twitter. Do you think? I mean, from your perspective, again, not asking you to speak for these protesters, but your sense of the movement in general, my sense is that sometimes there are some of us who perceive it as more metaphorical than this issue set is really about, as opposed to sort of, you know, broader, more ephemeral questions of white supremacy and systemic racism, that in many respects, Black Lives Matter is about specifically the threat to Black lives.
I mean, exactly. I mean, and I think it's been said so often, which is why it's very frustrating when people misrepresent the concept of Black Lives Matter, and the reason why people are annoyed or upset when the All Lives Matter gets dropped, or the White Lives Matter to or whatever gets dropped. Because the fact is, there's never been a question whether or not White Lives Matter. The fact is, we know that White Lives Matter. If someone, if a white person gets shot and killed, there's going to be excuses for as to why it happens. There's going to be, actual investigation. It's going to be looked into directly, whereas with black folks, it's actively, we're constantly dying. There's a state of emergency within the black community, and everyone's yelling about this, and then people aren't understanding, and they're looking at it, and they're looking at this issue as if it's like another just random progressive policy thing that would make things better. Oh, if we do this little thing here or there, as opposed to the fact that, like, people are dying. People are afraid to critique the Black Lives Matter protest. It's like critiquing someone who's in a burning fire saying you're yelling wrong. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think that is, I mean, that, and I think to a certain extent, my sense is that often the responses, and not even necessarily the critiques, but the answers to those cries are a little bit more, I guess to extend your metaphor, it would be, well, you know what we've got to do? We've got to install sprinkler systems in all the houses around the block. Well, this one's already on fire right now. And so that's
like,
a great...
If we add a better lining into the building, then these fires won't happen while people are still in the building.
Right.
And while currently burning. And you're not actively dealing with it. And then when people are upset, people wonder why. And like, and just a prime example of this, everyone keeps yelling about how Bernie Sanders was being shouted down. And it's like, I was there. It's like, and honestly, what happened was he came out. He had the opportunity to respond. The protests had already started. The protests had interrupted O'Malley. O'Malley, as problematic as he has been, at least acknowledged what was happening on the protest, acknowledged what they were saying, then screwed up with the whole All Lives Matter, White Lives Matter, then immediately came back within, I think, an hour and a half to go do our Twitter media state, sat down with L. Joy Williams, one of my anchors here at Just Speaking Blackness, and immediately apologized and said, like, and dealt with what happened, whereas Sanders didn't do that. And everyone's like, oh, well, they're attacking Sanders. Like, well, it's not so much an attack. It's like, if you don't, you have to know, you know your audience. If you know that before you come up there, there would be protests, people are upset, there is this big issue. You are running for president, and there is this issue that has been in the forefront of media for at least the past year. And you come out with a platform that does not, in fact, address these actual issues. And then when people come there, speak out and say, hey, we're upset, this is happening, please speak to this, say her name, and then you get on stage and you can't do it, you refuse to do it even, this is when the problem happens. It's not so much that people were going to attack Bernie Sanders, they're like, oh, he's your ally. Well, I was like, that's great, he's an ally, but has he actually laid out anything about how he will actually deal with this? Has he put down some policy that will actively deal with this state of emergency? And if you can't do that, you just say, oh, well, of course, like, oh, yes, Black Lives do matter, and this shouldn't happen, and I want some reform. It's like, what are you saying? What's going to happen? What are you going to do? Are you meeting with folks? Are you talking to the community? Or how are you putting together your plan in the first place? You can't just say nice things, because especially between Black folks and the progressive face and liberals and Democrats as a whole, we have been ignored so often, and we have been let down so often. Our issues are not put in the forefront. Our vote is very important, but our issues, yeah, we'll get to it. And it's getting to the point where it's like, enough is enough. If you actually want the support, because the fact is, no Democratic candidate can win without Black folks, or, and specifically Black women. So if you want this vote, then deal. Make sure you have this as a very prominent aspect of your platform, and if you don't, then you're going to be called out. And that's the point of protest. That's the point of primary.
What do you think of and I just want to sort of shift this slightly, because I think my sense is that is the one, what you've just articulated is the one, I guess, point that hasn't quite permeated some people's mind, understanding that there is, in some respects, what is being demanded is fairly narrow in its scope, obviously rather deep in terms of its importance, but it's not, just to go back to that metaphor of we can implement fire safety codes in a way that makes sure that this neighborhood has fire safety, proper fire safety codes to prevent fires, et cetera, but or to deal with it. But they're not just saying, like, we've got ladders here and we're going to go in and save people from this burning house. One being much more intense, but also narrower. Where do you think there is a role for some of that broader reform, or can that not come until this first thing is addressed?
I absolutely believe that there's a room for the broader reform. And the thing is that that conversation should happen at the exact same time. No one's saying it shouldn't. But you have to address what's happening at the moment. You have to address what people are living in fear of. Like there's a possibility by the time the election comes up, one of those people who were in that hall protesting, saying Black Lives Matter, will be dead. You know what I mean? And that's why it's so important, and that it has to be spoken on. Now, please, the broad reform. After you say, hey, we're going to deal with this thing. This will be on day one. I will make sure A, B, C happens. I will create this task force. I will meet with A, B, and C. I will have these people advising so that we can make sure this actually gets fixed. And then we're going to have to look at the broader system. How do we add this A, B, C over here? How do we fix this over there? How can we put certain issues together as a whole? But this has to stop now, and I'm willing to do the work to make this happen now. No one would complain. Everyone's like, fine. Now, will we trust them? Will we believe them?
Well,
we don't know, who knows? Because the fact is, a lot of people lie.
Right. And is it your sense that the solutions can come from the federal government as opposed to state governments, or is this another chew gum and walk at the same time type of situation?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the case. I think that it should be still looked at on the local level and in the state level. But there are things that can happen, especially the fact that when he appoints the attorney general, what type of attorney general will he appoint? Like, there are things that is going to happen from the presidential space. And there needs to be a knowledge that this is going to be a very important thing. This platform is going to be used to change this. He's going to use the bully pulpit to make sure that these types of policies get pushed down. That he's going to use his power in any way that he can to push down certain ideas, push down certain legislation that can happen, that will actually help the issue. And once that's laid out, then people will become much calmer. People are like, okay, fine, you're hearing what we're saying. Okay, let's hopefully, even though they might not trust, they'll say, let's see what happens then, as opposed to what's happening now, where it just feels as if people are screaming, saying, hey, you want our support, help us. And they're going, well, we'll get to it, but there's a bigger picture. Like, what are jobs? Like, great, I can have a job and still be killed.
Right.
Job's not going to make sure the cops won't kill me.
Right. I mean, particularly in the context of being in the wake of Sandra Bland's death.
Exactly.
She's on her way to a job.
I mean, in all honesty, the idea that he couldn't say, to say her name, that's literally what they were asking. Say her name, Sandra Bland. Say her name, Sandra. And he couldn't say her name. Like, because it's not like you need to know everyone. Like people are telling you. And there's people that are willing to have the conversation and meet with them, because I know for a fact there was a meeting with a bunch of Black activists and Black media spaces. I was invited to that meeting, and then Sanders canceled it. And after he had that in the morning, you would have thought that he would be like, okay, well, I need to at least understand this. I have some meetings with folks. This is all really tough for me. Let me try to figure this out. And then he ignores it. And so as great a liberal as he might be and a progressive, he has obviously has a lot of support. You're not showing it. You're not showing it to the people that are literally begging you to, like, say, hey, talk to us. Please say something to us. Wait, figure this out.
Yeah, putting any type of any other type of assessment aside for the moment, which I think, you know, isn't necessarily, what we should do, but it's just bad politics. I mean, it's just bad politics. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I would much rather, I'm not one of the people who really cares about authenticity or sincerity, but for it being a measure of a means in which to predict future actions. But I'm more concerned with results at the end of the day. I would much rather a cynic who delivers me results than one who is good-hearted and is not. But it's just poor politics, and that's I say this as a supporter of Bernie Sanders. I'm disappointed, and though there is some measure of indication that he, at the very least, got some part of the message in Dallas the next day, he mentioned Sandra Bland's name. I don't know if that's quite going far enough, but And I would imagine
I think it's a the fact that that happened in the aftermath of that protest. The fact is, O'Malley was scrambling. He went and apologized. All of a sudden, that night into the next couple of days, Sanders started adding it to it, his platform. Hillary Clinton puts out a statement on Facebook about this. And so, to me, that's why the critiques around the Black Lives Matter protests I find incredibly problematic, especially from progressive states, because, like, did you just not see that the protest actually worked?
Right, it worked.
That we are now talking about this issue.
Of course.
That it is at the forefront of it. Like, this is literally the point of protest.
Right, of course. And you know, I mean, I wasn't there, but I am fairly confident that in the absence of that protest, aside from this issue not being addressed, I could guess more or less what was going to be said. And so it's not like there was, you know, some great revelation that people were going to have, and this was going to be, you know, I mean, I think you know, it's there was some movement on something, and if there's movement on something, I think that's better than there not being movement on something. Alon, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your perspective. People can check out there's multiple shows at This Week in Blackness.
.com. The show that I host and that a lot of times is covering a lot of this news is Twit Prime. So they can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and at thisweekinblackness.com.
Thisweekinblackness.com. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Alon James White, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, sir.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. Extended show today. God, I just give and give and give. It's unbelievable. And look at Matt. New dad over there. He's carrying himself in a different way. I don't know. Noah, have you noticed that?
I have,
yeah. Noah said he has. Into the air. All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920. If you want to weigh in on the perspectives you've just heard, I have a feeling we'll be talking about this more as we go forward, but you know, it was weird for me not to go to Netroots Nation this year, and this was the biggest story that came out of it. So I was glad to get two different perspectives on people who were there, not necessarily part of the protest, but sort of understood the dynamics of what were going on. We'll take a quick break. Take your phone call, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM or get the app at majorityapp.com. We'll be right back. Right, Matt?
That's right. A little bit behind.
Everybody still has jet lag. We'll be right back after this.